Made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including International Galleries, Weber and Thies Law Offices, and ABC Billiards, an authorized Brunswick dealer specializing in pool tables, custom cues, and game room furniture. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
For this hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we dip into the archives and rebroadcast an interview from February 24th of this year when we talked with writers Paul Dixon and Tom Allen about their book, The Bonus Army, An American Epic. Because this was recorded back on the 24th of February, we won't be taking telephone calls this afternoon. Into the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. In 1932, thousands of veterans of the First World War marched on Washington to demand immediate payment of a bonus promised them in 1924 for the time they spent in service. The government said it would pay up, but not until 1945 or upon the death of a veteran. When the stock market crashed and the nation was plunged into the Great Depression, the veterans' situation worsened. Calling themselves the Bonus Expeditionary Force, thousands marched on Washington in May of 1932. There they set up shanty towns, but were forcibly evicted at the end of July by the U.S. Army. The fight didn't end, though, and in 1936 the long campaign paid off. They got their bonuses. Their victory was a pivotal one for those who would fight the next war. It paved the way for legislation to benefit the veterans of World War II, the GI Bill. On the Afternoon Magazine today, we'll hear more about this largely forgotten episode of American history. Two guests join us this afternoon. They are Paul Dixon and Thomas Allen, and they are the authors of The Bonus Army, an American epic. Our guests, Paul Dixon and Tom Allen, are the authors of many books. Paul Dixon has written about history, language, and baseball. Tom Allen is the author of books on the military and espionage. Their book, The Bonus Army, An American Epic, is published by Walker. Paul Dixon, Tom Allen, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Sure. Before you began the research for this book, were the two of you aware of the Bonus Army?
Vaguely, but we like so many Americans and so many people we've talked to since the book came out a couple of weeks ago, we were in the same boat as a lot of people. We sort of had a general idea of it. It was one line in the high school history book. It was always treated as sort of a little blip on the radar of the Depression. But so our learning process was that the reader will experience who goes through the book. We kept uncovering things that were mind-boggling in their impact.
Yeah, it's a story that kind of goes against the kind of the basic grain of the Depression story. I mean, in the Depression story, Hoover's the bad president, and Roosevelt's a good president who defeats him. But when we did the research, we started to find that the Bonus Army came back in 1933 expecting that Roosevelt would be pro-Bonus, but he turned out not to be. And so that was the first kind of twist that we started to see in a story that went on until the GI Bill.
Mm. Who have I just heard from just now?
No, that's Tom, yeah.
Okay, Tom. Yeah. And Paul was the first one to talk here this afternoon with us. Okay, very good. So the big question is, why has this been forgotten or at least overlooked?
Well, I think there are a bunch of reasons. But one of them, I think sometimes the wrong people behave, the bad people behave well, and the good people behave badly. I mean, there's a little bit of that where our preconceptions aren't entirely met. We can get into some of those later. I think another big aspect of this story that's been, the question is why are certain things marginalized and why are certain things up front? And I think there are a whole complexity of issues here that people didn't want to address along the way, one of which was race. There's a huge element of this story which we were not aware of when we began the work on this, but we began to see photographs one after another in the Library of Congress and in Cleveland Public Library, they had a lot of these. We kept seeing these integrated groups, and then we dug deeper and found that there was major integration at this event. And I think we also discovered that one of the reasons the bonus was denied, or at least forwarded in 1945, was there was fear that 800,000 black men would get money in the Depression, and that would overturn the whole economic system of the South.
Yeah, that was really interesting reading early in the going here in the Bonus Army, that and it came through to you clearly in a letter that someone wrote to the Cleveland Advocate, an African American newspaper. Quote, "For many months, the bonus question has been seesawing in our seat of government. It seems that the only opposition against it is the labor question, speaking more directly, Negro labor."
You know, the way it had been rigged in the South is there was a two-tier system, so that the lowest-paid white worker still was not the lowest-paid worker, because there were always black workers who were getting paid less. And it was a way to keep both the black and white down. And there was no equality in payment. But the bonus was designed so that if you were serving in the Army, black or white, you got a dollar a day bonus for service in the United States and a dollar 25 for service overseas, and it didn't matter whether you were black or white. And as Paul said, this has started to get things slowed down in the Congress.
Hmm. Now, America was a very segregated country at this point, and here we have a movement that became integrated. How did that happen?
I think one of the key to that may be the fact that both the white, the working poor at the time, or in the case of 1932, the non-working poor, because they didn't have any jobs. But I think what was happening was the blacks and whites were both being held back. I mean, the rich guy who came back from the war didn't have to really worry about his bonus. But so the white guys were being held. It was a sinking ship. They were both in trouble. And I think the whole pattern of segregation broke because they were both in the same boat, literally. And I think what happened was, when you see this Mississippi delegation coming out of it's 40% black and they're integrated. You see every state delegation in which there are both blacks and whites integrated, and that's the big shocker.
Yeah. Upon returning home after the war, what was the situation for these men? You report when the first waves of soldiers came back from Europe, the nation turned out to honor them, but the band stopped playing and the banners began to fade as they kept coming home. A number of related questions here. What was their situation when they returned home, the men who needed that money? How did their situation compare with those who had remained at home in the civilian workforce?
Well, that was the whole basis for the kind of the fairness that Congress was developing and the idea of compensation. The bonus, its real name was compensation. They felt that first of all, the men coming home were coming home to situations there was no guarantee for a job. I mean, you sort of started your life all over again. And wherever you were when you went away, that's where you were when you came back. But your job might not be there anymore. The people who were working, for instance, in a shipyard, a man working there was getting $15 to $17 or $18 a day. As a soldier, you would be getting a dollar a day, and you still had to pay for your uniform. So the idea was, well, at least give them a dollar for each day that they spent in the United States and a dollar and a quarter overseas. So it would come down to $500 or $600 or $700 or $800 per man. And in the 20s, before the Depression struck, the average veteran probably just saw this as pie in the sky by and by, because it was not going to be paid until 1945.
Mm-hmm.
But then, when the Depression comes, everybody wants the money right away. They need it. They don't have homes. They don't have jobs. And Wright Patman, a populist and himself a veteran of World War I, is in Congress, and he introduces legislation for immediate payment of the bonus. And that's what starts everything off.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to 1924, when the veterans mm-hmm. were promised the bonus to begin with, although it wasn't to be paid until 1945 or upon their deaths. and then it would be paid to survivors.
Mm-hmm.
Why had it taken so long for Congress to approve the compensation in the first place?
I think there were a number of issues. I think one was that this racial thing, which was behind that was sort of the puppet master behind it all. There was a huge resistance to the racial component, the fact that blacks would be treated equally. And there were a huge number of them, 800,000 in the war. I mean, it was a large number of people. And the other thing I think was this genuine sort of cheapness, this fiscal conservatism. But the guys who led it, who were really opposed to it because it would cost the country money, were people like Andrew Mellon, who were among the richest men in the world, and of course who had all prospered during the war. They had all their industries had benefited from the war, and they're the very guys saying, no, we can't afford this. We can't afford this. And so, you asked a minute ago about the individual guy. I mean, we have one sort of everyman in the book, guy they call, his name is Cassidy, his nickname was the man in the green hat. I mean, it's a colossal character because he sort of emphasizes the hypocrisy at the time. He comes home wounded. He has a job with the railroad. He lives in Washington, has a job with the Pennsylvania Railroad. He can't get his job back because he's wounded, because he's damaged goods. So he gets a friend of who's in Congress, sets him up as the bootlegger to Congress because prohibition has been brought into play. So here's this guy. Congress won't give him his bonus, but they'll give him a job selling illegal booze in the basement of the Senate.
Yeah. Well, prohibition provides that wrinkle.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was a kind of feeling of betrayal, too, because, that was passed while all these guys were overseas, and they come back to a world that has prohibition in it, no jobs. But they start moving through the 20s, and it's really not until, even though they have this bonus in 1924, it's in their future somewhere, there's no real talk about it until it looks like something that would help out during the Depression if they could only get it right away.
Mm. You know, another reason we need to address that this episode of American history has been largely forgotten is that it was seen as a movement of radicals, of communists.
Right. And there wasn't any basis for that except the fact that there was a fear that something was going to happen either from the left or the right. They looked to Europe and they saw that post-war Europe in Russia, in Germany, in Italy, all were in chaos, basically because politicians had managed to organize the returning veterans. And over here, well, what's going to happen? We're going into a terrible time. Is somebody going to organize the veterans and bring down the government? Are they going to bring it down from the left or the right? And the Communist Party was really aiming at the veterans and aiming at the unemployed. And although they weren't getting anywhere, there was this fear. And as the bonus march began, Army Intelligence and the Justice Department started looking at who these men were and what was this all about. And the reports were, they actually wrote reports in secret codes and radioed them to Washington about the bonus march. And they were seeing radicals. Sure, the Secret Service had men in infiltrating the ranks, and they said these are patriotic Americans. They are unarmed. They don't have trouble in plans. They're just lobbyists. They call themselves lobbyists in boots. They were heading to Washington to lobby for legislation that had been introduced by Rod Patman.
And the other problem in this communist or the leftist thing is, There are, of course, a couple communist guys in it who are also veterans who basically want to, have a different sort of worldview. But the chief of police after the summer, after 45,000 of these guys had passed through, he said there are a maximum of 150 communists, of whom some were followers of a couple key guys. But they never got traction. They were kicked out of the main camps by the vets. But what was happening, the amazing thing, and these are reports that were just classified in the last decade, a lot of the reports coming in would report to the Army, let's say the intelligence would say they were Negroes and people with Jewish features at these meetings, which was their code word for radicals. I mean, that's all they had to say was, well, of course, these are radicals because they're blacks and Jews. And, of course, it's absurd, but at that time you could get away with something like that. I mean, it's just amazingly wrong.
Yeah. You write early in the book, I believe in the prologue or the foreword, that when this story is recalled, those who recall it are prone to slant events to advance their own political beliefs. Would you like to say something further about that?
Well, you're kind of advancing the story, but when Hoover writes his memoirs years after the event, he characterizes the Bonus Army as radicals and crooks and Reds, and MacArthur pretty much does the same thing. When the McCarthy era appears in the 50s, this kind of crystallizes the idea of them as Reds, and people were writing that into political in political power. When Eisenhower runs in 1952, on the other hand, the Democrats accuse Eisenhower of being one of the architects of driving the Bonus Army out of Washington. So it becomes a political football on the edges of some of the political events of the times.
Mm-hmm. I know I'm kind of moving the story along here, guiding the discussion in a way that's not particularly linear, but it's such a big story that I want to make sure I get in some of the big issues
sure,
here
please.
At the top. And I have a caller who's waiting to talk with us, and after we talk with this this listener, I want to play for our listeners the audio side of some newsreel footage that the publisher sent to us along with the book. And I think that also raises some interesting issues of how it was that the story came to be told the way it was told for many, many years. Our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Paul Dixon and Thomas Allen, they are the authors of The Bonus Army, an American Epic. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our first caller this afternoon is a listener in Indiana on line 4. Hi.
Hello. The money was legislated in 24. What was the rationale for actually dispensing it in 45 or at the death of the soldier? I know the Southerners controlled both houses, whatever party was in there. So I'm wondering if was it just purely the Negro thing that they just didn't want to pay anybody and thought back and by 45 it'd be forgotten or some law would be made for the disenfranchised wouldn't get any money whatsoever?
Basically they wanted to make sure they had the money in the bank. And they were, the Congress was going to be putting little, putting sums of money in, earmarked for the bonus from the year 1924 to the year 1945. That was the fiscal side of it.
The other thing that really compels them is one of the things that gets the thing through, they know there's just one presidential veto, and they know there's a veto out there, no matter who's president, right from the beginning all the way through Roosevelt, who throws three vetoes at the bonus. And so one of the only ways they can get it passed, anyone can get it passed, is to agree to the 1945, because Coolidge will let it go. Only he will allow the vote to only go without the, if it's only paid in 1945. But the other thing about it is, they just don't want to spend the money, and they're spending money on everything else. And this is 24. There's a period of real prosperity. I mean, there's plenty of money around.
Very interesting. So we have Calvin Coolidge, we have Herbert Hoover, we have President Franklin Roosevelt. All three fighting this compensation.
And Harding.
Yeah,
and Harding.
Okay.
The first veto is with Harding.
Okay.
See, it's proposed right from the start. I mean, as soon as these guys get back, it's proposed. And there are people who really think it should be paid, especially vets. I mean, the Congress, there were so many vets going into Congress, and they're the ones who are really spearheading it. Right, Patman. Later on, the only guy to stand up to Franklin D. Roosevelt was Harry Truman, was a vet, and he was never went against Roosevelt except on this one issue.
Hmm. Well, let's now move ahead to the year 1932, and Congressman Patman drafts a bill calling for immediate compensation.
Right.
And it fails. And on the other side of the country, we have a veteran by the name of Walter Waters. Tell us about him.
Well, he stands up at a veterans meeting in Portland, Oregon. And curious thing, he has heard about Patman's bill. He's read the newspapers. He also somehow, there's some reference in his background, he knows about Gandhi and peaceful assembly. And he says, there are guys lobbying. There are banks and big corporations lobbying in Washington. We have a right to lobby. So let's all go there and lobby. And he gets about 150 or 200 veterans in Portland, Oregon. They go down to the rail yard, and they hop freights. The railroad men, most of whom are vets, let them on, and they head for Washington. And that's the beginning of the bonus march in May 1932.
Mm-hmm.
Very specific reason. They're going to lobby for the bill that is now locked up in committee. And if Congress isn't lobbied, then that bill will die in committee.
Mm. And how was it that this effort of this fellow, Walter Waters, how was it that it caught fire?
That's the great question. What happened was the newspapers and the radio stations were desperate for good stories. It was a very, very bad year, and they were tens of thousands of people wandering aimlessly with no purpose, and their banks were shutting down at an alarming rate. And all of a sudden, the papers start, as these guys went east, and they run into a lot of problems along the way, and they're stopped. And there's, you know, so as the news sort of quotient of this thing grew, they were all over the papers, the wire services, the radio, and these people all over the country heard this. And they said, let's go, let's go, let's get it. So people started from Los Angeles, and they started from Boston, and they started from Mississippi. So as Waters is moving across the country with this little group, which is picking up disciples as he goes, these other groups start moving. So some of them, say, from Camden, New Jersey, which is much closer to Washington, they actually arrive before Waters because they're getting the word. The word is spreading. And within about a week to 10 days after Waters has arrived, there are 10,000 vets in the city. And by the end of the summer, there's at least 45,000, maybe even more. But so it's this one guy, and he's fairly articulate. He's quoted in the papers. He's sort of an everyman. I mean, he's lost his job as a foreman in a cannery factory. He's fought in two wars. He rose to being a sergeant. He's a fairly, but he's just a nobody in the middle of the Depression. Of course, we learned the other day, we were talking to a film critic who said that Waters informed Frank Capra. He was Frank Capra's model for this one this guy who just steps up to the plate and goes to Washington and changes things.
Hmm. What became of him?
Oh, boy. Toward the end of the summer, when things were looking rough, he suddenly decides he's going to start an organization called the Khaki Shirts, which is patterned on the black shirts, fascists. And he's going to organize all the veterans of the United States and form a powerful political party. Nothing at all comes of it. The next thing you hear about him is quite a while after the bonus march, there's a little story in the paper and a picture of him, and he's been hired by General MacArthur to be a clerk in the War Department. And then you don't hear much about him. But when World War II comes, he reenlists in the service, and he becomes a soldier in World War II.
And he dies in the 70s in Washington in a VA hospital.
And the only obituary we found has no mention of his participation in the Bonus Army.
Hmm.
It was just an old man in a VA hospital.
Yeah.
He dies.
What a story.
Yeah. I had breakfast with his great-grandson last Friday in Seattle. So I just throw that in because it's been an interesting couple of weeks.
I bet. People that you've talked to that survived this, or their offspring that you've talked to,
mm-hmm.
What kind of conversations have you had with these
folks? The people we talked to, of course, were kids in 1932.
Yeah.
I mean, most of them we saw. And there are two in particular. We have a picture of them in the book. There are two little kids about 7 or 8 years old who during the Depression, their father had put them in a makeshift boxing ring in their hometown in Pennsylvania, and they would have an exhibition boxing, and then somebody would go around, pass a hat, and pick up, 80 cents or a dollar. So he takes the two of them to the bonus march, and they arrive at the big camp in Washington, and they put on boxing shows while the old man goes off into Washington looking for work, you know, day work. And they just remember it as one of the great summers of their lives because they had the freedom of the camp. They would go down to a bakery in the morning and get some stale bread that the bakery would give the kids, and they just had a wonderful time. Then we interviewed a couple of elderly black men who were kids in Anacostia, and they had the same experience. They just running around the camp, and it was something that gave a lot of people in Washington a focus on the Depression. It was called a Hooverville. I mean, it wasn't any paradise, but the veterans put on ways of getting money. They'd have a flagpole sitter, or they'd bury a guy alive in a coffin. You could go and look at him for a nickel. And they had baseball games, boxing matches. There were songs all the time. There was music all over the place. And it wasn't as grim, at least at the beginning, as other places in the Depression were, other shanty towns.
People actually fell in love with these guys. I mean, and a lot of the big writers would come down and write about them. John Dos Passos and Sinclair Lewis. All these people get involved, and so it becomes sort of like a World's Fair almost. In a funny way, the music is just all there all the time. So it's really a different kind of place. And the Washingtonians just love these guys. They just fall in love with them.
Hmm. And there are tens of thousands of people here descending on Washington and living there for most of the summer, 45,000, and not only veterans but their families,
mm-hmm,
as well.
Many of them brought their wives and children,
and the crime rates go down. There's a little panhandling, but the real crime goes way down. And of course, in the middle of this, we is Roy Wilkins, who's then working for the NAACP magazine. And he comes down. He's basically wants to get on the road and report on things that are really happening. And he shows up in the middle of the camp, in the middle of the summer, and he is flabbergasted because he just can't believe his eyes when he's seen. At one point in his article that he writes, he talks about black and white feet sticking out from under the same pup tent, you know, in the middle of the night, and hears the music, and there's a white guy playing St. Louis blues, and then a black guy's playing, you know, shanty in old shanty town, and he sees this as the model for the America that the integrated, productive America. And this, of course, is denied. If you were reading the New York Times or the Washington Post, you would have not an inkling of this. This was not written about.
Hmm.
There's a kind of self-censoring that was going on, primarily because of this feeling that if blacks and whites get together, it's an indication of some kind of problem or some kind of trouble. But there's no trouble. There's no problem. Things are going well. And they even are turning the Congress around. The bill comes out of committee, and it's passed by the House. The next thing is to have it passed by the Senate, and, of course, Hoover's going to veto it. But the guys are all rallied by the fact that they've found friends in Congress who see they see the merit in immediate payment of the bonus.
Hmm. I mentioned in my introduction that, you know, the victory that these folks eventually won was important for those who would fight the next war, the GI Bill. It also seems, though, that what we have here is also a paving of the way, perhaps, for the civil rights movement before the veterans came back from World War II, which is often seen as the beginning of the civil rights movement.
Because that really plays through. And what you see, the other component of that, and of course, even when Martin Luther King plans the Poor People's Campaign, Resurrection City, his advisors, his senior advisors, remember the bonus march. And all of the big encampments, well, of course, he's been killed by the time that actually happens. But again, that's what's informing a lot of these marches that have come since then, the civil rights movement. The original "I Have a Dream," which was held with Roy Wilkins sitting behind Martin Luther King. All of this is informed by the Bonus Army, and one of the other key component beside this concept of all people coming together for a common cause, whether they be different races or not. The other big thing that comes into play is you've got a cop in Washington named Pelham Glassford who becomes almost heroic. I mean, he is heroic. He basically learns. He's the one who teaches the nation that the way you deal with people who are coming into protest or lobby or whatever they're doing, or that people come into town, you know, you don't greet them with billy clubs, and you befriend them, you work with them, and you do everything you can to maintain order. And he becomes he's the guy who, you know, shells almost $1,000 out of his own pocket to feed these guys. He does everything he can for them. When they have registration cards, the cop is the number one. The head of the police is the first member of the Bonus Expeditionary Force. The camp, the huge camp that they have built in Anacostia, is Camp Marks, M-A-R-K-S, which was named for the precinct head of the thing. But of course, in the 50s, there's actually a comment where somewhere somebody said these guys were so red they had a camp Marks, M-A-R-X. But it's actually named for a cop. You know, the Marks is this guy. You know, this guy, the guy who really likes it's not Glassford. But I think that's the other thing. I think the nation learns to deal with protesters. And I think all of the people who have come to Washington since, rather than being greeted with billy clubs and tear gas, were greeted with cops who understood that these guys have just as much right to the streets as they do.
Yeah. Well, somewhere along the line in between reading the book and looking over other materials, Richard Nixon was well aware of what happened.
Yes. Yeah, he says, "I'm not going to be a quivering Quaker like President Hoover." And he's the one, I mean, when he goes down and talks to the Vietnam protesters, he's doing what he felt that Hoover should have done. But Hoover never meets with them, never talks to them, sees them as radicals from day one. And that thought that he has is encouraged by all of his advisors. It's encouraged by MacArthur, by the Secretary of War, Patrick Hurley. They all see them as radicals, as people who are going to disturb the orderly process of government, maybe even try to overthrow the government.
Hmm.
And if you know, that's the beginning in some ways of the anti-communist movement in the United States, just as what happens toward the end in the GI Bill is the beginning of the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's now move up to July 1932 and the dismantlement, which might even not be a strong enough word to describe what happened to the camps.
The turning point in the summer is when the Senate doesn't pass the bill. The House has passed it. And June 16th, the Senate meets, and they don't pass it. It was late into the night, and there are 10,000 veterans surrounding the Capitol, which is an extraordinary scene if you think about it. And the senators escape the building by actually going through underground tunnels and getting out. Waters is on the porch, literally on the porch of the Senate, and Heath says... he's told that he has to tell him that the bonus has been defeated in the Senate. And a female reporter named Elsie Robinson from the Hearst Papers whispers something in Waters' ears, and she says, and Waters bellows out, "Sing America, sing America," and they all start singing America. And they go home that night. The singing diffuses their anger. They go home. They go back to their tents. And, of course, Washington wakes up the next morning expecting these guys to be gone. And what they don't realize is that most of them don't have a place to go to. And Waters has a press conference, and he says, "Well, it's been defeated, but we're going to stay here until 1945 or until it's passed, whichever comes first." And of course, they just don't leave. A couple do, but I mean, they don't leave. And that sets up the things start to get worse as the summer progresses. You know, there's a lot of rain. The camps turn into mud. It's very hot. Some questions of public health.
Yeah, there were predictions that disease would breakout that the camps were unsanitary and needed to be taken down.
You know, just as though the political undertone of that, this never shows up in the annual report of the Director of Health in Washington. They're looking for reasons to get rid of these guys. And finally, what happens is the White House lets the word out through the city is being run by three commissioners appointed by Congress, not by a mayor. I mean, there's no elected official. So the three commissioners who are answerable to Congress push to have the police evict the veterans who are in half-demolished buildings. They're there legally. They tell them, Glasser, the chief of police, has put them there and said, you can stay here. These are buildings that are going to be torn down someday, but you know they're half-built. You're half-torn down. You can stay in them. And they have to be evicted. These are the downtown veterans. These are the ones, if you come into Washington, you see them. And getting rid of the sight of them is what's going on behind the scenes. The big encampment, where there are thousands of veterans camped, is across the Anacostia River. So it's the downtown veterans are supposed to be evicted, and the police begin evicting them on July 28th.
Hmm. And when does the Army come in?
Well, the eviction goes badly. What happens is there's a little scuffling in the morning. And Glassford's trying to get them out of there with good humor, and it gets a little nasty in the morning. Somebody rips the badge off Glassford's shirt, and they take a break for lunch, and they come back after lunch, and there's a rogue cop who basically starts getting in a tussle with a couple of the guys, and probably maybe a brick is thrown, but there are two guys who he pulls out his revolver. This cop does, and there's never been a firearm involved in this thing. And he pulls out his gun, and Glassford sees what's happening. He screams at him, "Stop, you fool!" And this guy actually threatens Glassford to shoot Glassford. Glassford dives behind a pile of rubble, and this guy turns around and kills two of the marchers. This then sets it up. Even though Glassford is starting to get it back under control, even after one guy dies later, but even after this event, Glassford is trying to get under order, but the word goes across the river to MacArthur, who's been building this huge force, some of which is down the river in about 3 or 4 miles down the river, and then this huge group of this is going to come over from Fort Myer, and they come across with tanks, with tear gas, with bayonets, with horses. This is a huge thing. Tanks come rumbling down Pennsylvania Avenue of the first time in history, and it's pretty dramatic. And they start the business of getting the downtown evacuated of all the veterans, and that's what Hoover wants. He wants the downtown cleared. Well, of course, the other mitigating factor is this has been on the radio all morning. Some people think it's a parade. They hear about these horses coming down Pennsylvania Avenue, the tanks. People come out of federal buildings. They come downtown to see it. They think it's a day of frolic or something. I mean, it's just people are just attracted. So you've got tens of thousands of Washingtonians in this whole mess.
Yeah. We're going to have to kind of wrap up here in about 6 minutes. So so just kind of a heads up here, we're going to cover quite a bit of territory here in the next couple of minutes. You know, I mentioned the newsreel. We're not going to have enough time to play that this afternoon, but that is an amazing... I'm sorry we can't tell that. I think what I'll do is I'll have it put up on our website, but so people can listen to it if they want to. But the story that came out then out of this, told in newsreel and I assume in newspapers and whatnot, just a totally different kind of story than what you've laid out for us today.
Well, some of the papers got it right. Some of the best reporters in the country were there, and there is a moment where MacArthur disobeys Hoover and crosses the Anacostia River and burns them out. And the reporters, there's actually one reporter who buys them enough time to get the people out of these hovels in Anacostia. But there is a great attempt. The newsreel is actually booed. You hear the newsreel, it sounds like these guys are evil.
Mm-hmm.
But people would see MacArthur and they would actually boo them because they were veterans against soldiers against veterans.
And the newsreels were really in the pocket of the administration. They all through this, the newsreels had stayed away from the kind of the positive side. There's no newsreel showing the vets putting on a ball game or the Songfest that were going on at the camps. the newsreels were told, stand by for trouble. And if trouble starts, that's when we want them. And, of course, trouble starts on July 28th, and that's when you get the newsreel. But the newspapers, as Paul said, were on an overall basis, were more sympathetic. But what the administration starts to do is a big campaign of what we would now call spinning. And they start spinning it that these are all communists, these are all crooks, they're not really veterans. J. Edgar Hoover supplies a lot of incendiary material from the Justice Department. MacArthur gets a lot of that kind of information from the military intelligence. And within a few days, the story is it was just a bunch of radicals. And the story almost gets lost to history with that take on it.
Yeah. But then a couple of years later, story turns around.
Yeah.
With a hurricane in Florida.
And this is, Roosevelt is opposed, as much opposed to it as Hoover, and he actually has a veto between a joint session of Congress to veto it. But and the Congress is more and more, every time it comes up in 33, 34, every time it comes up, 35, every time it comes up, there are more votes, but there's always the veto, and they can't override the veto. And what happens in Labor Day of 35, Roosevelt, these guys just keep coming back again and again, and he finally, the New Deal finally realized they got to get these guys out of town, so they sent a lot of them to these work camps in Florida, and these are not very nice places to be, but there's a huge hurricane that comes, not huge in size, but in velocity and power, and kills 250 of them on Labor Day weekend 1935. There's an immediate attempt to blame this on the New Deal, including Ernest Hemingway, who writes this incendiary article blaming Roosevelt for their death because the trucks that could have gotten them out of there are locked up, and the train that's supposed to get them doesn't come on time, and it's just a bureaucratic sort of mess. But it's enough to get it's basically becomes the impetus where Congress now has enough votes because of the deaths of these guys, to override the veto in 36. And so Roosevelt vetoes it again, and of course then they get paid.
Yeah.
And there's $2 billion poured into the economy in 1936, and it's a little bonus for Roosevelt, too, because he's running for re-election.
Hmm. The economy gets a shot right about...
Yeah. Lessons for us today.
Well, what happens to veterans is they have to fight for their rights. It seems like it happens every generation, that they come marching home and people don't give them what they thought they were going to get. The GI Bill turned things around tremendously because it showed that veterans could be drawn into what becomes America's middle class. But every generation has to find a new way to remind themselves about veterans' needs.
Yeah. That contract is an important one.
Yeah.
Yep. Sure is.
There we'll have to leave it.
Okay.
Great story. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
For the chance.
Really wonderful time.
Yep.
Paul Dixon and Tom Allen have been our guests this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. They are the authors of The Bonus Army, an American Epic. The book is published by Walker. And that interview was from February 24th of this year. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Joining us now with settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade, Todd Gleason. I don't think the guys are ready to do the report. So I'll tell you what we'll do here. We'll play a little music, perhaps. Do we have an underwriting that's due? Why don't we do that? Jason Croft, my technical director. Thanks.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater. Information on the full line of Subarus available from Paul Moser or Kelly Weatherall, certified Subaru specialists. Email address, Subaru@wardenmartin.com.
Okay, I think Todd is ready now. Hi, Todd.
Oh, I'm always here at 49, and what was I doing today talking to Dave Dickey?
Well, you got this big show coming up.
Preoccupied, you bet. Yeah. We do have a big show coming up this afternoon.
Hour-long closing market report.
Thanks to you, by the way, for offering up the time during the Afternoon Magazine each and every Thursday in April. And first three Thursdays in May, we take up Ag Policy Radio. Today, we'll be talking to Tom Bias, an Indiana native, who is the government relations specialist at the National Farmers Union. We're calling it Ag Policy Radio, a look from just left of the center from the National Farmers Union. Hopefully you will join us about 20 after the hour of 2 o'clock this afternoon Central Time during the closing market report, an expanded program, and we will take your phone calls. Dave Dickey and I are looking forward to having you get on your cell phones. If you're a farmer or a consumer and interested in ag policy, this is a good one to tune in to. We've done the background. We've done the history. We've talked about the food and feeding programs. We took a look at the WTO and the kinds of things that puts into the system for this next farm bill debate, what kind of influences it might have. And now, as you say, the time to pay the master is the piper has finally come, and we'll be talking directly to some of the folks. We'll be lobbying Congress about this next farm bill. This week it's the National Farmers Union. Next week we'll talk with the Farm Bureau. The week after that it'll be the Family Farm Coalition, and we'll close out with Conservation and the American Farmland Trust on May the 19th. Enough about that. Settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade like this on the afternoon. May wheat futures today had a high of 321, a low at 315. Settlement price there at 317 and a quarter. They were down 2 and a quarter on the day. July 331, the high, the low at 324 and three quarters. Settlement price 327 and a quarter, down 2 cents. September futures 338, the high, the low at 333 and a half. Settlement price at 336. They're down a penny and a quarter. And the December contract at 348 high. Low at 343 and a half for the December. It settled at 345, a penny and a half lower in the March contract. 355 and a half, the high, the low at 352. Settlement price at 354. They were off a penny today. Dave Dickey and I talking about this just a little bit, looking across the grains floor and especially at the oil seats, thinking, well, we were a bit surprised that they pushed lower today, especially on the news yesterday that Asian soybean rust had been found again in Georgia. They had it last year, and it was found at the same sites, by the way, that it was identified last year. So there is some debate as to whether that blew in from Florida, it was on the direct path for the wind, or whether that managed to overwinter there, and they did have some freezing weather. So that'll be kind of a fun debate to watch, and we'll make sure that we discover how that happens over the coming weeks. But as you might have expected, futures would have gone higher today. Did not happen in the corn pit. The May futures today, 3 3/4 lower, down at 204 and a half with a high of 209 and a low at 203 and 3/4. July futures, 217 and a half, the high, the low at 212 and a half. Settlement price at 213, they're down 4 cents for the day. And September futures, 225, the high, the low at 220 and a half, and a settlement price at 220 and 3/4, down 3 3/4. December contract in the corn pit, 234 and a quarter, the high, the low at 229 and 3/4. Settlement price there at $2.30 and a quarter cents. They were down 4 cents for your new crop, Red December. March futures in the corn pit now, 241, the high, the low at 237 and a half, settled on that low, down 3 3/4. And the May contract, 242 and a half. Settlement price there down 3 1/2 with a high of 45 and a quarter and a low at 42 and a quarter. May oats on the day, 147, the high, the low at 42, settled on that low, down a nickel. And the July, 149 and a half, the high, the low at 44, settled a penny above that at 145, and they were off 3 1/4 for the day. From the soy complex, nearby beans were down 9 1/4 cents today. 631 and a half, the high, the low at 617, settled 618, down 9 1/4. We'll definitely be talking to Dan Zwicker this afternoon of AgriVisor Services after last week's big push from him to move this thing higher. It's interesting to watch this go down 9 1/4. We'll ask him why. July futures, 638, the high today, the low at 625. Settlement price at 625 and a quarter, down 8 1/2 cents. And the August futures, 634 and a half, the high, the low at 624 and a half, settled 624 and 3/4. They were down 7 1/4. And the September's, 631, the high, the low at 620 and a half. Settlement price at 620 and a half, down 6 cents. November futures were off 3 3/4 today. They had a high of $6.29, a low at 618, and a settlement price at 19 3/4. January beans now, 630, the high, the low at 620 and a half. Settlement price at 621 and a quarter. and they were down 3.25 for the day. Bean meal futures, 197.50, the high, the low at 194.10, settled 194.70. They were off $1.30. July futures in the meal pit at 197.20 on the high, the low at 193.50. And their settlement price, 193.80, down 170. May bean oil futures, 22.67, the high, the low at 22.20, settled 22.23, down 28. And July futures, 22.72, the high, the low at 22.31. Settlement price there at $22.35. They were off 32 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, Todd. April feeder cattle, the high today, 111.70. The low, 111.55. The settlement, 111.65. That up a nickel. May, 108.50. The high, 107.67 and a half. The low, 108.40. The settlement, that up 40. August, 108.40. The high, 107.85. The low, the settlement, 108.15. That up 12 and a half. April live cattle, 92.70. The high, 92.20. The low, 92.35. The settlement, that down 10. June, 85.82 and a half. The high, 85.45. The low, the settlement, 85.60. That down 2.5. May lean hogs, 77.45. The high, 76.75. The low, the settlement, 77.30. That up 22.5. June's high today, 77.70. The low, 76.50. The settlement, 76.70. That down 22.5. July, 78 even. The high, 77.10. The low, 77.62.5. The settlement, that up 17.5. August lean hogs, 75.25. The high, the low, 74.50. The settlement, 74.95. That up 7.5. And May pork bellies, 82.35. The high, 81.50. The low, the settlement, 81.60. That down 35. The Dow off 124 points at 10,075. The NASDAQ off 23 at 1907. The S&P 500 down 12 at 1144.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, helping to create a storehouse of possibilities and products from a single seed. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Jeff Edberg from Iowa City, Iowa, writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why does the moon rotate on its axis at the same rate it revolves around the Earth?"
It does seem a little too neat, doesn't it? I mean, what a coincidence that the two rates of rotation, one around its own axis, the other around the Earth itself, are equivalent. It's a cleverly constructed denial mechanism to hide the far side of the moon from viewers on the Earth. Like a teenager obsessed with his own acne, the moon suffers from the delusion that it would lose the few friends it has if anyone saw the real moon. The fact is, the far side of the moon looks pretty much like the near. And yes, it is pockmarked. Those who love the moon wouldn't have it any other way. But try telling the moon that.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree.